Chapter 2. What Fixed the Destinies of My Life. Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Nothing is required for this enlightenment except freedom, and the freedom in question is the least harmful of all, namely, the freedom to use reason publicly in all matters. Immanuel Kant, What is Enlightenment? The best news I can tell you is that Williamsburg begins to brighten up and look very clever. Peyton Randolph. Williamsburg, the colonial capital, suited Jefferson wonderfully. It had an intellectual climate informed by the very latest in books, and a social swirl that included Virginia's most charming women and most prominent men. It had the professor, William Small, the lawyer, George Wythe, the royal governor, Francis Fouquier, and the statesman, Peyton Randolph, all of whom became critical in Jefferson's life. It had lively distractions. Jefferson gambled on horses and hunted foxes. He gossiped and courted and danced. Above all, Williamsburg had an ethos that was to enthrall Jefferson, the drama and glamour of politics. To Jefferson, this was the great world, and the college was an integral part of Virginia life. George Washington received his surveying certificate from William and Mary. Other alumni included future Chief Justice John Marshall, future President James Monroe, and some 17 governors of Virginia. There were also reminders of the grim facts of life in the colony. In the mid-1760s, a French traveler in Williamsburg saw three Negroes hanging at the gallows for robbery. Jefferson was enrolled in William and Mary from the time he was 17 until he was 19. He was then in and out of the city for an additional 5 years as he studied law. Williamsburg had as lasting an influence on the man Jefferson became as Shadwell did. In the decades to come, in moments of crisis and of calm, he returned there in his mind's eye, finding direction in the political lessons he learned and guidance in the ideas he explored. College life centered on the Wren Building, which was, in 1760, a 3.5-story brick-walled structure topped by a cupola. A chapel and crypt had been added in the previous 30 years. 3 blocks east, along Duke of Gloucester Street, was Bruton Parish Church on the left, followed by the Palace Green, leading to the Governor's Palace. Farther down Duke of Gloucester sat the brick Capitol, home to the House of Burgesses and the General Court. There, then, in not quite half a square mile, no one landmark more than a few minutes' walk, or an even briefer ride in one of the carriages that were so prominent when Williamsburg was full and busy with the public business, was the whole structure of public power in Jefferson's Virginia. No one could have loved it all more than Jefferson himself. For Jefferson, William and Mary was largely about what university life is supposed to be about: reading books, enjoying the company of the like-minded, and savoring teachers who seemed to be ambassadors from other, richer, brighter worlds. Jefferson believed Williamsburg the finest school of manners and morals that ever existed in America. The man who put him on the path toward that hyperbolic but heartfelt conclusion was Dr. William Small, a Scottish layman and professor who brought an Enlightenment worldview to Williamsburg. It was fortuitous that Jefferson encountered Small at all, for Small's stay on the faculty at William and Mary lasted only 6 years, from 1758 to 1764, the right period to overlap with Jefferson, who revered him. It was my great good fortune, and what probably fixed the destinies of my life, that Dr. William Small of Scotland was then professor of mathematics, a man profound in most of the useful branches of science, with a happy talent of communication, correct and gentlemanly manners, and an enlarged and liberal mind, Jefferson said. Born in Scotland in 1734, he was less than a decade older than Jefferson. Small was, in addition to professor of mathematics at the college, the interim professor of moral philosophy. Described by a contemporary as a polite, well-bred man, Small lived in 2 rooms in the college. The accommodations, it was said, were by no means elegant, but Small and his colleagues were very well satisfied with the homeliness of their appearance, though at first sight they were rather disgusting. A bit more care seems to have been taken with clothing than with interior decoration. Faculty were expected to have a suit of handsome, full-dressed silk clothes to wear on the king's birthday at the governor's, where it was expected that all English gentlemen attend and pay their respects. Small taught ethics, rhetoric, and belles lettres, as well as natural philosophy, what we think of as the sciences, and mathematics, lecturing in the mornings and holding seminar-like sessions in the afternoons in which the professor and his students discuss the material. Conversant with the thought of Bacon, Locke, Newton, Adam Smith, and the philosophers of the Scottish Enlightenment, Small introduced Jefferson to the key insight of the new intellectual age, that reason, not revelation or unquestioned tradition or superstition, deserved pride of place in human affairs. Under Small's influence, Jefferson came to share Immanuel Kant's 1784 definition of the spirit of the era. Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity, Kant wrote. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without guidance from another. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. This was Small's message to his charges at William and Mary. Jefferson was entranced, later giving Small the noblest of accolades when he recalled that Small was, to me, a father. It was said that Jefferson studied 15 hours a day, rising at dawn and reading until 2 o'clock each morning. At twilight in Williamsburg, he exercised by running to a stone a mile from town. At Shadwell, he rowed a small canoe of his own across the Rivanna River and climbed the mountain he was to call Monticello. For Jefferson, laziness was a sin. Of all the cankers of human happiness, none corrodes it with so silent, yet so baneful a tooth as indolence, he told one of his daughters. Time spent at study was never wasted. Knowledge, Jefferson said, indeed is a desirable, a lovely possession. Like his father, he believed in the virtues of riding and of walking, holding that a vigorous body helped create a vigorous mind. Not less than 2 hours a day should be devoted to exercise, and the weather should be little regarded, Jefferson once said. In fact, Jefferson believed the rainier and the colder the better. A person not sick will not be injured by getting wet, he said. It is but taking a cold bath, which never gives a cold to anyone. Brute animals are the most healthy, and they are exposed to all weather. And of men, those are healthiest who are the most exposed. Aspiring attorneys, he said, should devote their mornings to the law. But variety was key. Having ascribed proper hours to exercise, divide what remain, I mean of your vacant hours, into 3 portions. Give the principal to history, the other 2, which should be shorter, to philosophy and poetry. Jefferson was always asking questions. With the mechanic as well as the man of science, a descendant recalled, Jefferson learned all he could, whether it was the construction of a wheel or the anatomy of an extinct species of animals, and then went home to transcribe what he had heard. He would soon be known as a walking encyclopedia. Jefferson could play as hard as he worked. Worrying that he had spent too much money in his first year in what the 19th century biographer Henry Randall called a little too showy style of living, particularly in the article of fine horses, Jefferson wrote a guardian offering to charge the whole of his bills to his separate share of the estate. More amused than alarmed, the guardian declined Jefferson's offer. Later in life, Jefferson wrote, I was often thrown into the society of horse racers and card players, fox hunters, scientific and professional men. Many a time have I asked myself, in the enthusiastic moment of the death of a fox, the victory of a favorite horse, the issue of a question eloquently argued at the bar, well, which of these kinds of reputation should I prefer? That of a horse jockey? A fox hunter? An orator? Or the honest advocate of my country's rights? In truth, these things are not mutually exclusive, which Jefferson knew. He spent his Williamsburg years in ways that suggest he understood that the pursuit of knowledge could coexist with the pursuit of pleasure. The motto at Williamsburg's popular Raleigh Tavern had it right. Jollity, offspring of wisdom and good living. It was in the governor's palace, not at the Raleigh, that Jefferson's most intensive tutorial in the art of living well, as measured in elegance and conversation, two things he cherished, took place. Francis Fauquier, the royal governor of the colony of Virginia, held frequent gatherings with William Small and George Wythe, one of Virginia's greatest lawyers. Fauquier's formal title was Lieutenant Governor. The official royal governor delegated the actual work of the post. Thomas Jefferson made a fourth at what Jefferson called Fauquier's familiar table. There was dinner, conversation, and music. The older men nurtured Jefferson's passion for the violin, and Jefferson was invited to join Fauquier on the governor's musical evenings, performing in the palace. Fauquier was born in 1703, only 5 years before Peter Jefferson, and so was roughly the age Jefferson's father would have been had Peter Jefferson survived. The governor loved science, fine food, good music, and spirited card playing. No dry philosopher, Fauquier also had a worldly, even rakish air. The story was told that he came to office in the New World through the good grace of Lord Anson, the British admiral who had circumnavigated the globe, after Fauquier lost everything he had to Anson in a single night of cards. However embellished that tale, its currency shows that the man Jefferson encountered at this impressionable age led a life in which the pursuits of pleasure, power, and erudition unfolded simultaneously. Fauquier's father was a Huguenot physician who worked with Sir Isaac Newton at the Royal Mint and became a director of the Bank of England. The son, too, was interested in science and became a fellow of the Royal Society, as well as a director of the South Sea Company. Evidence of his keeping a hand in both the world of ideas and of practical power, something the young Jefferson may have noticed. Fauquier was energetic. Within weeks of his arrival in Virginia in 1758, there was an unusual July hailstorm. The ice smashed the windows on the north side of the governor's palace. Fascinated, Fauquier wrote a scientific paper about the phenomenon and dispatched it to his brother, who presented it to the Royal Society in London. Born in 1726 in Elizabeth City County, Virginia, the lawyer George Wythe was also a noted statesman. Hawk-nosed, and in Jefferson's description, of the middle size, well-formed and proportioned. Wythe was wise, intellectually curious, and probably had more direct influence on Jefferson's thinking than Small simply by virtue of longevity. Wythe taught Jefferson in the law and other subjects for 5 years, an unusually long period of time. The older man lived in a house near Bruton Parish Church in the center of Williamsburg. Mr. Wythe continued to be my faithful and beloved mentor in youth, and my most affectionate friend through life, Jefferson recalled. In Wythe, the man with whom Jefferson spent the most time in the period from roughly 1765 to 1772, Jefferson had a teacher in both liberty and luxury. The older man had expensive tastes, sending to London for satin cloaks for his wife, velvet breeches and black silk stockings for himself, and for them both, an elegant set of table and tea china with bowls of the same, of different sizes, decanters and drinking glasses, a handsome service of glass for a dessert, 4 middle-sized and 6 lesser dishes, and a handsome, well-built chariot. The Wythes also loved to entertain. Mrs. Wythe puts 1/10 very rich Malmsey to a dry Madeira and makes a fine wine, Jefferson once noted appreciatively. In a literary commonplace book in which he copied passages that struck him as important, Jefferson quoted Euripides during the years with Wythe, "There is nothing better than a trusty friend, neither wealth nor princely power. Mere number is a senseless thing to set off against a noble friend." In 1767, Wythe introduced Jefferson to the practice of law at the bar of the General Court, inaugurating Jefferson's legal career, a phase of Jefferson's life that consumed him from 1767 until 1774, when the work of the Revolution drew him into politics and diplomacy. When those close to Jefferson surveyed his life and career, they returned to the governor's palace and to the influence of the bright men who moved through those elegant, high-ceilinged rooms. "Apart from the intellectual improvement derived from such an intercourse," wrote Henry Randall, "Mr. Jefferson, it is said, owed that polish of manner which distinguished him through life to his habitual mingling with the elegant society which Governor Fauquier collected about him." For the rest of his life, Jefferson sought to replicate the spirit and substance of these long Williamsburg nights. At his round dining table at Monticello, in the salons of Paris, and in the common rooms of boarding houses and taverns in Philadelphia and New York, and finally at the President's House in Washington, D.C., Jefferson craved talk of the latest in science and the arts, and adored conversation with the beautiful women, politicians, and men of affairs who made the world run on both sides of the Atlantic. In this elite number, Jefferson also included his cousin Peyton Randolph, Attorney General of Virginia, Speaker of the House of Burgesses, and the first President of the Continental Congress. Born in 1721, Randolph was at once convivial and imposing. On meeting him, Silas Deane of Connecticut wrote that Peyton Randolph was of an affable, open, and majestic deportment, large in size, though not out of proportion. He also commands respect and esteem by his very aspect, independent of the high character he sustains. Small, with Fauquier and Peyton Randolph established the standards by which Jefferson judged everyone else. They represented a love of engaging company, a devotion to the life of the mind, and a commitment to the responsible execution of political duties for the larger good. Under temptations and difficulties, he told a grandson, I would ask myself, what would Dr. Small, Mr. With, Peyton Randolph do in this situation? What course in it will ensure me their approbation? Jefferson was to be always guided by experience and example, thinking about what men of the world, men he respected and loved, might do. For in their day, their decisions had given them, in Jefferson's words, very high standing, standing that Jefferson felt the incessant wish to match and surpass. In pursuit of that standing, Jefferson never cut himself off from the social and cultural currents of his time. When, on holiday from Williamsburg, he played his part in the rites of Virginia hospitality, often hosting others at Shadwell or visiting friends at their plantations. On a visit one winter to Colonel Nathaniel Dandridge's place in Hanover County, Jefferson met Patrick Henry, a young man living in Louisa County. Jefferson recalled that the two passed perhaps a fortnight together at the revelries of the neighborhood and season. His manners had something of the coarseness of the society he had frequented. His passion was fiddling, dancing, and pleasantry. He excelled in the last, and it attached everyone to him. Jefferson conceived of life in social terms, and he believed that his own identity was bound up with the world around him. A slave was always in attendance. Family, neighbors, and callers were more or less constant presences. I am convinced our own happiness requires that we should continue to mix with the world and to keep pace with it as it goes, he once wrote to one of his daughters. He was a political man in the purest sense of the term. He lived among others, engaged in the business of living in community, and enjoyed being at the center of everything, no matter what the everything was. He was a happy member of the FHC, or Flat Hat Club, at William and Mary, a secret society that, as Jefferson put it, had no useful object. Even the bustle of a plantation paled in contrast to the charms of Williamsburg. When away from the capital, he longed for intelligence about what he might be missing. If there is any news stirring in town or country, such as deaths, courtships, and marriages, in the circle of my acquaintance, let me know it, Jefferson wrote his college friend, John Page. For a time in the early 1760s, Jefferson was in love, passionately, if ineffectually, with a young woman named Rebecca Lewis Burwell, the sister of his classmate, Lewis Burwell, Jr., of Gloucester County. His letters on the subject are about what one would expect of a young man not quite 20 years old, overstated, breathless, self-serious, and melodramatic. His attempts at humor and self-mockery in his correspondence about Rebecca Burwell fall largely flat, and the episode is chiefly interesting for the light it sheds on Jefferson's sensitivity to rejection, disorder, and criticism. Little about the courtship went well. Even rats and rain seemed to conspire against him. On Christmas Eve, 1762, at Fairfields, a brother-in-law's place in Goochland County, Jefferson went to bed as usual, leaving his pocketbook garters, and watch in his room. The watch held a paper drawing of Rebecca Burwell, the single token Jefferson appears to have had of the object of his affections. Awaking on Christmas morning, Jefferson discovered not only that rats had gotten into his room and gnawed at his pocketbook and garters, the rodents spent part of the night only inches from Jefferson's head, but that rain in the night had leaked into the house, soaking the watch and destroying the image of his beloved. To the lovesick Jefferson, the accidents seemed terrible omens. In this season, he compared himself to Job and wondered, "Is there any such thing as happiness in this world?" His answer, "No." About a month later, in January 1763, writing from Shadwell, Jefferson was still gloomy. "All things here appear to me to trudge on in one and the same round. We rise in the morning that we may eat breakfast, dinner, and supper, and go to bed again that we may get up the next morning and do the same, so that you never saw two peas more alike than our yesterday and today," he wrote John Page. Jefferson always wanted some level of control, too, and he savored secrecy. "We must fall on some scheme of communicating our thoughts to each other, which shall be totally unintelligible to everyone but to ourselves," he wrote Page as they shared gossip about courtships, dances, and lovers' maneuverings. His feelings for Rebecca grew stronger as the year wore on. 9 months later, on Thursday, October 6, 1763, Jefferson decided to declare himself. There was a dance that evening in the Apollo Room of the Raleigh Tavern in Williamsburg with its brightly lit banqueting hall. In this elegant setting, Jefferson believed his hour had come. "I was prepared to say a great deal. I had dressed up in my own mind such thoughts as occurred to me, in as moving language as I knew how, and expected to have performed in a tolerably creditable manner," Jefferson wrote the next day. He was dancing with Rebecca in an agreeable company. Everything appeared set. He tried to speak, and it all fell apart. "But good God," Jefferson wrote afterward, "when I had an opportunity of venting them, a few broken sentences uttered in great disorder and interrupted with pauses of uncommon length were the two visible signs of my strange confusion." His humiliation was nearly complete. Yet he did not capitulate totally, not without one additional attempt, a conversation in which Jefferson opened my mind more freely and more fully. He had plans, not then realized, to travel to England, but his heart was Rebecca's, if she would have it. Sort of. As Jefferson told the story to his friend John Page in January 1764, he made his intentions clear to Rebecca without committing himself, which gave Jefferson a degree of dignity and control. "I asked no question which would admit of a categorical answer, but assured her that such questions would one day be asked." In the end, there were no further questions. There were, in fact, no further interviews of any kind between the two. Defeated, he made his retreat. After he was rejected by Rebecca, Jefferson experienced what may have been the first instance of an ailment that was to recur at times of stress, a painful, prolonged headache. Characterizing himself as abominably indolent in a letter to a friend written late on a March evening, Jefferson said that his scheme to marry Rebecca was now totally frustrated by her impending marriage to the wealthy Jacqueline Ambler of Yorktown, which took place in May 1764. Then, in an apparent allusion to prostitution or to sexual activity with enslaved women or with women in the servant class, it is unclear which, but these seem the likeliest possibilities, Jefferson wrote, "Many and great are the comforts of a single state, and neither of the reasons you urge can have any influence with an inhabitant, and a young inhabitant, too, of Williamsburg. For St. Paul only says that it is better to be married than to burn. Now, I presume that if that apostle had known that Providence would, at an after-day, be so kind to any particular set of people as to furnish them with other means of extinguishing their fire than those of matrimony, he would have earnestly recommended them to their practice." It was nearing midnight as he wrote these words. He was suffering from his headache as the candle burned down, and Jupiter, his personal slave, fell asleep. Perhaps it was the intimacy of the hour that encouraged his candor. Perhaps he was boasting vainly. But Jefferson had some reason to say that Providence had given men like himself the means to satisfy his sexual appetites, means he appears to have made use of. This much was clear. Jefferson needed to get his mind off his lost love. Fortunately for him, he was a man of wide interests, interests his teachers and mentors were nurturing as his lovesickness faded. Chapter 3. Roots of Revolution. Our minds were circumscribed within narrow limits by an habitual belief that it was our duty to be subordinate to the mother country. Thomas Jefferson. For Thomas Jefferson, politics were ubiquitous. They were the air he breathed. "May we outlive our enemies," Jefferson once wrote in a private note to himself. On the same page of a memorandum book on which he noted that he had sent to London for summer clothes for his slave Jupiter and scarlet cloth for his own waistcoats, he added an aphorism, "No liberty, no life." To follow Jefferson in the 1760s and early 1770s is to see how the American Revolution took shape and why. The definition of liberty and the nature of representative government, fundamental human questions, were consuming concerns in the America of Jefferson's young adulthood. In these decades, London held power over the American colonies. The British Navigation Acts controlled trade and transportation. Merchants in Philadelphia or farmers in Albemarle County were subject to an economic system in which they had no real political voice. Royal governors could convene colonial assemblies, such as the Virginia House of Burgesses. The governors could also veto any legislation and were empowered to dissolve the sessions at will. No directly elected representatives of the British in North America sat in the British Parliament. Such issues were to grow in scope and significance as Jefferson himself grew older. In 1754, when Jefferson was not yet 12 years old, at a convention in Albany, New York, the American colonists made a proposal known as the Albany Plan of Union. It was a bid to become a largely self-governing province under a national royal governor. Its author, Benjamin Franklin, noted that the plan collapsed because Americans thought it too autocratic, and the British found it too democratic. When Jefferson was 14, he inherited his father's edition of Paul Rapin de Toira's History of England, a book that sheds light on the roots of the American Revolution, for the American story of the 18th and 19th centuries was inextricably linked with the story of England in the 17th. Americans who knew their British history, and since most Americans were provincial Britons, most of them did, understood political life to be a constant struggle to preserve individual liberty from encroachments of crown and courtier. With the British politician and writer Henry St. John, Viscount Bolingbroke, Jefferson believed history was philosophy teaching by examples. History, then, mattered enormously, for it could repeat itself at any time in any generation. And if that history brought tyranny, it was to be fought at all costs. First published in 1723, Rapin's book held that the story of England, and thus of English peoples, such as the Americans, was the story of the battle between monarchical and, relatively, popular authority. Whigs were oriented more toward the Parliament and the people, Tories toward the King. Jefferson took this way of thinking about politics seriously, later arguing that all societies were likely to be divided into such camps. The drama of the English Civil War, the Restoration, and the Glorious Revolution had shaped the American view of life and politics. In books by Rapin, Bolingbroke, and others, history was depicted as a war between the few and the many for ultimate power. In Britain in the 17th century, the people, including many aristocrats, had rebelled against the absolutist tendencies of the Stuart kings, leading to chaos. There was the execution of Charles I, the Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell, the restoration of the Stuarts, which led to more political and religious strife, and finally, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when William of Orange and his wife Mary were crowned to preside over a balanced constitution. As a condition of kingship, William and Mary agreed to uphold an English Declaration of Rights that limited the monarchy's power to abuse the rights of individuals and of Parliament. Through the constitutional settlement of 1689 to 1701, England achieved order and protected liberty with a balance of powers. Americans of Jefferson's time lived in an atmosphere in which life was viewed in the context of the episodic tyranny that had roiled the mother country in the previous century. Security could be found only in a mixed government in which the executive, the monarchy in Britain's case, was checked by a bicameral legislature made up of commons and lords. An independent judiciary also played a key role. The history Americans wanted was that of a balanced constitution. The history they would go to war against was that of anything less than a government they judged fair and representative. By virtue of his birth and education, Jefferson was disposed to support the American cause. The inclusion of Rapin's multi-volume History of England in Peter Jefferson's library suggests an ancestral sympathy for the worldview Thomas Jefferson would help propel to the center of the Atlantic world. Henry Randall, the early Jefferson biographer, reported that Peter Jefferson was a staunch Whig, and he adhered to certain democratic, using the word in its broad, popular sense, notions and maxims which descended to his son. Ever curious, Thomas Jefferson went further into the matter than most. He read Tacitus's Germania, and became an adherent of the theory that England was initially populated by freedom-loving Saxons, who were subjected by the monarchical and feudal forces of William the Conqueror. According to this view, Americans were now heirs of the Saxon tradition of individual freedom, a tradition long under siege. Jefferson and his fellow American revolutionaries took the positions they did, positions that led to war in 1775 and the Declaration of Independence in 1776, partly because they saw themselves as Englishmen who were being denied a full share of the benefits of the lessons of English life. In the decade between 1764 and 1774, between a protest over taxation to the eve of revolution, Jefferson and like-minded Americans were guarding against the abridgment of the personal liberties or of the representation Englishmen had won for themselves as a result of the Glorious Revolution. Every proposal from London, every thought of a tax, every sign of imperial authority, raised fears of tyranny in America, for such proposals, taxes, and expressions of authority in the 17th century had produced such tyranny in the mother country during the Civil War and the Restoration. The arguments over taxation and representation, which were really arguments, of course, about liberty and control, gained fresh force at the conclusion of the French and Indian War, also known as the Seven Years' War, or the Great War for the Empire. The conflict of arms had ended in 1759 on the Plains of Abraham, but the fighting between the French and their Indian allies on the one hand and the British and the Americans on the other led to a Cold War over money and power between the old and new worlds. Empires are expensive, and the one London controlled at the end of the Seven Years' War was of remarkable scope. Simply put, London needed revenue, and believed the American colonies should bear more of the cost of maintaining the British dominions. About 10,000 British troops were to remain in North America. The Redcoats represented a pervasive sense of threat. Armies that could liberate and protect could also conquer and subjugate. The imperial authorities were now reaching ever more deeply into the lives and fortunes of Americans, Americans who watched such assertions of power warily, fearful that despotism was at hand. Before the French and Indian War, London had not exercised strict control over grants of the western lands beyond the Appalachian Mountains. After the war, and after an uprising of Ohio Valley Indian tribes against British posts, London sought to give the king the power to decide the fate of the western lands, a move that particularly alienated Virginians, accustomed to speculating freely there. Before the war, London had not been especially rigorous in its enforcement of navigation acts to regulate trade. After the war, London opened a campaign to use writs of assistance to board and search colonial vessels, enraging Boston in particular. The South and West were angry about the lands and the Indians, The Northeast was uneasy about the writs of assistance, and the whole of the colonies was infuriated by what was known as the Sugar Act of 1764, which included mechanisms for strict enforcement. Though the bill actually lowered the tax on molasses, it imposed duties on other items, including Madeira wine, a favorite of the young Jefferson. The Sugar Act was also an attempt to establish a principle and a precedent in these post-Seven Years' War days, that, in the words of the legislation, it was just and necessary that a revenue be raised in Your Majesty's said dominions in America. In the House of Commons on Friday, March 9, 1764, Prime Minister George Grenville, a Whig politician who served as head of government from 1763 to 1765, had risen to announce the Sugar Act and the prospect of a colonial stamp tax, a tax on documents and things made of paper, including newspapers and playing cards. Grenville told the House that he hoped that the power and sovereignty of Parliament over every part of the British dominions, for the purpose of raising or collecting any tax, would never be disputed. Yet disputed it was, and would be. Americans were avidly reading the Massachusetts lawyer James Otis's Rights of the British Colonies Asserted and Proved, a kind of forerunner to Thomas Paine's Common Sense, the 1776 pamphlet that made a compelling case for the American cause. Otis's views were abroad in the colonies in the autumn of 1764, when, in Williamsburg, George Wythe drafted a petition to the House of Commons protesting taxation. His language, however, was considered too strong by some burgesses, even treasonable, which suggests that Wythe, the man closest to Jefferson and whom Jefferson idolized, held decided opinions on the questions that led to revolution. The essence of the anti-British position was summed up in a 1764 resolution that Virginia sent to the king and to Parliament, that the people are not to be subject to any taxes but such as are laid on them by their own consent, or by those who are legally appointed to represent them. Virginia's resolutions had no effect on the outcome in London. Parliament did not even consider them, and the Stamp Act passed on Friday, March 22, 1765. The subsequent drama offered Jefferson his first intimate glimpse of politics. The Virginia debates over how to respond to the Stamp Act had a bit of everything: emotional rhetoric, imperial tension, generational division, and legislative sleight of hand. There were principles at stake and ideas to be refined and applied to the real world, and there were raw political and human calculations. It was a perfect laboratory for the struggles that concerned Jefferson for the rest of his life. A significant number of the members of the Virginia House of Burgesses wanted to take a stand against Parliament's assertion of power. But how far should the Americans push the Whig interpretation of the rights of the colonies and of individuals? At this point in 1765, the notion of a full clash of arms with Great Britain was remote, even to men like Patrick Henry, whom Jefferson watched speak in the House on Thursday, May 30, 1765. It was already late in the House of Burgesses' spring session. Many members had left Williamsburg for home. Jefferson, yet a student, as he recalled, was there to watch the action. A number of Anti-Stamp Act resolutions, seven in all, were in play. On the floor, Patrick Henry, the self-taught lawyer and charmer, whom Jefferson had first met at Nathan Dandridge's house, was pressing for the boldest of the measures. Jefferson stood at the door of the house, listening to Henry in wonder. With eloquence Jefferson believed great indeed, Henry said Tarquin and Caesar had had their Brutus, Charles his Cromwell, and Henry, according to the single contemporaneous account of the debate, did not doubt but some good American would stand up in favor of his country. Jefferson was swept away. "He appeared to me to speak as Homer wrote," Jefferson said of Henry. A French traveler who was watching with Jefferson recorded that the Speaker of the House, hearing Henry invoke Brutus and Cromwell, said that Henry had spoke treason. Henry backed down. According to the French observer, Henry said he was ready to ask pardon, and he would show his loyalty to His Majesty, King George III, at the expense of the last drop of his blood. but what he had said must be attributed to the interest of his country's dying liberty, which he had at heart. With Henry's rhetorical flight ending, a divided House took up the resolutions. The struggle on the floor, Jefferson said, was most bloody. Records of the deliberations are scant, but the formulation at issue seems to have been this, which was apparently framed as the fifth resolution put forward by Henry. Resolved, therefore, that the General Assembly of this colony have the only and sole exclusive right and power to lay taxes and impositions upon the inhabitants of this colony, and that every attempt to vest such power in any other person or persons whatsoever other than the General Assembly aforesaid has a manifest tendency to destroy British as well as American freedom. Men such as Peyton Randolph wanted to strike a more moderate tone for the moment, but the stronger language passed by the narrowest of margins, 20-19. "By God, I would have given 500 guineas for a single vote," Randolph said afterward. One more vote against the resolution would have tied the count, and the Speaker, John Robinson, would have voted no, defeating it. Instead, the Radicals had won. Going on record against London was itself not as disturbing to the more moderate members as was the sense that they had lost control. Patrick Henry had taken on the establishment and succeeded. As night fell in Williamsburg, a triumphant Henry left the capital. He had won, or so he thought. The next morning, it was now Friday, May 31st, 1765, Jefferson could not wait to return to the House. Intrigued by the cut and thrust, he arrived at the chamber early. Once there, he discovered another Randolph cousin, Peter Randolph, already at work. Randolph was examining the records of the House to find a precedent for what the leadership hoped to accomplish once the bell rang the burgesses into session. Rescind the fifth resolution, undoing Henry's victory and regaining command of the field. Jefferson was therefore witness to a bid to overturn the previous day's result. An hour or so later, the House took up the matter and reversed itself from the day before. Henry's departure had given his foes an opportunity they did not fail to exploit. Though the records of the House are silent about the Stamp Act on May 31st, Governor Francis Fauquier wrote the Board of Trade that, after a small alteration in the House, presumably Henry's departure, there was an attempt to strike all the resolutions off the journals. The fifth, which was thought the most offensive, was, accordingly, struck off. The lesson for Jefferson, the man who would come to be seen as the great Democrat, tribune of liberty and scourge of elite authority? Never give up the political fight, and never shy away from using any and all means to carry the day. Only 6 weeks after his 22nd birthday, Jefferson had been given a tutorial in the intricacies of power. On Thursday, he had been thunderstruck by Homeric oratory evoking the glories of liberty and asserting that to give Parliament any control over Virginia or her sister colonies would do nothing less than destroy American freedom. Then on Friday, he watched the prior day's defeated faction become today's victors through resilience and opportunism. Unwilling to give up, Henry's foes were vigilant and resourceful, seeing their chance in his departure and taking steps to find precedent to give their course of action the color of authority. Important, too, was mastery of the means, in this case the legislative process, to give oneself the ability to achieve the desired end. In later years, whenever Jefferson was able to seize unexpected political moments and turn them to his advantage, he appreciated the role of tactical skill. He had seen it all demonstrated late in a Williamsburg May. Fauquier saw, too, that things were changing. On the following Tuesday, June 4, 1765, he hosted the annual birthnight ball in honor of George III, usually a spectacular occasion in Williamsburg. Not this year. "I went there in expectation of seeing a great deal of company," wrote the anonymous French traveler, "but was disappointed, for there was not above a dozen of people. I came away before supper." As the Stamp Act debates unfolded, Jefferson's own first significant public act, the memory of which he cherished, was an elaborate attempt to bend the natural world to his purposes. To do so, He used his mind and the arts of quiet persuasion. The Rivanna was not navigable for boats carrying crops from Albemarle farmers to market. Climbing into a canoe, Jefferson set out to learn whether anything could be done. Paddling along the river, his friend Margaret Bayard Smith, once described as wild and romantic, Jefferson discovered that the removal of rocks below Milton Falls could transform the Rivanna into a vital route for his and his neighbors' crops. Jefferson raised private money to undertake the project, successfully making the case to individual investors. In October 1765, the Colonial Assembly praised Jefferson's laudable and useful work and authorized the clearing the Great Falls of the James River, the River Chickahominy, and the North Branch of the James River. Jefferson was thrilled. He was working in the tradition of his father, bringing order to the wilderness, and, no small thing, being recognized and honored for it. For Jefferson, the 11 years between the Stamp Act battle in Williamsburg and the Rivanna work in 1765, and the formal Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia in 1776, was a time of steady maturation, intellectually, politically, and emotionally. Like many Americans, he was an unlikely revolutionary. His journey from loyal subject to leading rebel reveals Jefferson to be a pragmatist as well as an idealist, a man who understood the importance of using philosophy and history to create emotional appeals to shape broad public sentiment. Leadership, Jefferson was learning, meant knowing how to distill complexity into a comprehensible message to reach the hearts as well as the minds of the larger world. In 1766, Jefferson helped bring a Maryland publisher, William Rind, to Williamsburg to create a Virginia Gazette to rival the one that was controlled by Joseph Royal, John Dixon, and Alexander Purdy. Until the beginning of our revolutionary disputes, recalled Jefferson, we had but one press, and that having the whole business of the government and no competitor for public favor, nothing disagreeable to the governor could get into it. Fascinated with how to marshal men, he studied the political arts, not only in books, but in Williamsburg and Albemarle County. A poor public speaker himself, he admired gifted orators such as Patrick Henry. Shadwell, a convenient stopping place for those making their way to and from Williamsburg, was open to all sorts and conditions of travelers, including Ontacete, the Cherokee chief who crossed the Atlantic in 1762 for a celebrated visit to George III. The moon was in full splendor, Jefferson recalled, and to her he seemed to address himself in his prayers for his own safety on the voyage and that of his people during his absence. His sounding voice, distinct articulation, animated actions, and the solemn silence of his people at their several fires filled me with awe and veneration, although I did not understand a word he uttered. When it came to the spoken word, Jefferson knew that he could not compete in such arenas with such men. Armed with this insight, he cultivated alternative means of influencing others. He studied the folkways of deliberative bodies. He learned to write with grace, with conviction, and, important in a revolutionary time, with speed. He immersed himself in the subtle skills of engaging others, chiefly by offering people that which they value most, an attentive audience to listen to their own visions and views. Politicians often talk too much and listen too little, which can be self-defeating. For in many instances, the surer route to winning a friend is not to convince them that you are right, but that you care what they think. Everyone wants to believe that what they have to say is fascinating, illuminating, and possibly even epical. The best political figures create the impression that they find everyone they encounter to be what Abigail Adams said Jefferson was, one of the choice ones of the earth. A grandson described Jefferson's tactical approach to personal exchanges. His powers of conversation were great, yet he always turned it to subjects most familiar to those with whom he conversed, whether laborer, mechanic, or other. There was a method to his habit beyond the acquisition of information. Henry Randall tells the story of a most intelligent and dignified Virginia matron of the old school, who often hosted Jefferson at her table. She was, Randall reported, wont to boast that Jefferson never failed to inquire with great particularity how her best dishes were compounded and cooked. Though she suspected that charm was at work, even flattery, she was also convinced by the apparent sincerity of Jefferson's manner of listening. "I know this was half to please me," she allowed, "but he's a nice judge of things, and you may depend upon it, he won't throw away anything he learns worth knowing." With her, as with so many others, Jefferson knew what he was doing. The autumn of 1765 should have been a heady time for Jefferson. In July, his sister Martha had married his friend Dabney Carr, an alliance that pleased Jefferson beyond measure. The Carrs set up housekeeping in Goochland County, at a place called Spring Forest that was along Jefferson's route to and from Williamsburg. Young and bright, beloved and respected by his teachers in Williamsburg, popular in the aristocratic circles of Virginia, and with the Rebecca Burwell debacle fading from his memory, Jefferson thought the world a largely happy place. Then, on Tuesday, October 1, 1765, his sister Jane died, reminding him anew, in the manner of his father's death and of the failed romance with Burwell, of the fragility of life. He had loved Jane, and his grief as the autumn of 1765 gave way to the new year was so deep that it endured in family lore. "The loss of such a sister to such a brother was irreparable," a great-granddaughter wrote. Drawing on the works of the English poet William Shenstone, a writer much interested in mourning and in the virtues of rural seclusion, Jefferson composed an epitaph in Latin for Jane, which reads in translation, "Ah, Joanna, best of girls! Ah, torn away from the bloom of vigorous age! May the earth be light upon you. Farewell forever and ever." In the last week of March 1766, nearly 6 months after Jane died, Jefferson began his garden book, an episodic record of the lives and deaths of flowers and vegetables. He longed for spring. "Purple hyacinth begins to bloom," he wrote on Sunday, March 30, 1766. "Narcissus and puckoon open," he noted on April 6th. The puckoons, or bloodroot, were not long for this world. A week later, on his birthday, "the puckoon flowers fallen." Still mourning Jane, he was torn between home and the larger world. As the weeks fell away, he planned an excursion north. His first journey outside Virginia foreshadowed much in his life. His ability to conceal anxiety beneath a cool veneer, and his urge to engage the world of politics. Setting out in the spring of 1766, Jefferson, always concerned with combating and controlling diseases, stopped at Philadelphia to see Dr. William Shippen, Jr., to be inoculated against smallpox. Jefferson continued on to New York, where, in a sign of the intimacy of the American elite, he boarded in a house along with Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, a future revolutionary friend and ally. It was a perilous trip. Twice on the first day, Jefferson's horse broke away from him, greatly endangering the breaking of my neck. The second day brought terrible rains, and Jefferson could find no shelter on the road. The third day, he was fording a stream and was nearly swamped by unexpectedly deep water. He was among strangers, too, for the first time in his life, seeing no face known to me before. Stopping in Annapolis, which he found extremely beautiful, and whose houses he thought rather better than those in Williamsburg, Jefferson was drawn to the Maryland Colonial Assembly. His description of the chambers, which he found wanting, and of the lawmakers, whom he also found wanting, are rich in detail. He was not impressed by the appearance and the seriousness of the Maryland legislators. He was snobbish about his fellow colonists. "I was surprised on approaching it to hear as great a hubbub as you will usually observe at a public meeting of the planters in Virginia," Jefferson told John Page. He noted that the speaker's wig was yellowed, and to the young Virginian, the man had very little the air of a speaker. The close cataloguing of the assembly suggests his interest in the workings of power. It was natural for Jefferson, now a son of Williamsburg, to document his impressions of the seat of a neighboring colony. The spirit of the hour, meanwhile, was momentous. "I would give you an account of the rejoicings here on the repeal of the Stamp Act, but this you will probably see in print before my letter can reach you. In London, Parliament had stood down from the stamp duties, but passed the Declaratory Act, asserting its view that it possessed the power to levy taxes on its colonies in all cases whatsoever. For Jefferson, the story of the Stamp Act had begun in the lobby of the House of Burgesses. That it ended for him when he was on the road gave him his first tactile evidence that the American story and the American cause was larger than Williamsburg and larger than Virginia. His conception of the American nation may owe something to the celebrations he watched on the Maryland shore. In 1767, Jefferson was admitted to the bar of the General Court of Virginia after his study with George Wythe. He lived at Shadwell with his mother, but traveled often. Cases took him to courthouses from Stanton to Winchester. His sister Martha wrote him a report from the garden in early June, noting that his carnations were in bloom 71 days after being planted. His interest in the garden and the farm was practical as well as ornamental. In late November 1767, he calculated how much hay he would need to store up to feed his horses through the winter nights. Contemporaries recalled Jefferson as a bright, enthusiastic, and intellectually curious lawyer. His practice was eclectic. One case involved the theft of a bottle of whiskey and a shirt. Another, a charge of slander in which a David Frame sued a man for saying he saw Frame, who is a married man, in bed with Elizabeth Birkin, etc. Jefferson's friends loved him. His clients appreciated him. His elders admired him. He was the kind of man other men thought well of and believed they could trust, unless, as one of his best friends was to discover, a beautiful young wife was in the picture. Chapter 4. Temptations and Trials. You will perceive that I plead guilty to one of their charges, that when young and single, I offered love to a handsome lady. Jefferson, in an 1805 acknowledgment of his infatuation with Elizabeth Moore Walker. Under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. Jefferson, in the Howell Slavery Case, 1770. It would have been adultery, but Jefferson was too much in love, or thought he was, to care. Attractive and virile, a powerful and charismatic man, he wanted what he wanted, and he did not give up easily. Elizabeth Walker was what he wanted. She was the bride of his friend John Walker, a man he had known virtually all his life. The connections between the two men were old and deep. Peter Jefferson had made Walker's father one of his own executors. Dr. Thomas Walker of Castle Hill was among those who had watched over young Thomas. The two boys followed a similar path, boarding at James Morey's school before going to the College of William and Mary. We had previously grown up together at a private school, and our boys' acquaintance was strengthened at college, John Walker recalled of his friendship with Jefferson. We loved, at least I did sincerely, each other. Elizabeth Moore, known as Betsy, was a granddaughter of a royal governor and daughter of Bernard Moore, the master of Chelsea, a tidewater plantation in King William County. Two of her brothers attended William and Mary with Jefferson and her future husband. In January 1764, a period in which he remained gloomy about Rebecca Burwell, Jefferson had reported his friend's impending marriage. "Jack Walker is engaged to Betsy Moore," Jefferson wrote John Page from Williamsburg, and desired all his brethren might be made acquainted with his happiness. There is irony in the phrasing, and perhaps envy. Still smarting from his rejection by Rebecca, Jefferson was in no mood to celebrate another man's romantic good fortune. His melancholy was exacerbated by the absence of his horses, which he had sent up the country. "Without them he felt marooned," he said, "for it was now out of my power to take even an airing on horseback at any time." The letter to John Page was dated from Devilsburg, Jefferson's dark rendering of a Williamsburg that had not given him the bride he thought he wanted. The world seemed bleak. Even poor John Walker, Jefferson thought, would have to forego the joys of a pretty wife for a while longer. But I hear he will not be married this year or two. Jefferson was wrong. Less than 5 months later, in the first week of June, 1764, Betsy Moore and John Walker were married at her home at Chelsea. Jefferson was in attendance, John Walker recalled, as the friend of my heart and as a groomsman. By 1768, the Walkers were living, with an infant daughter, in a house known as Belvoir, only 5 or so miles from Shadwell. Like Jefferson, Walker was a rising man in Virginia politics. Soon, Walker agreed to join a delegation bound for Fort Stanwix in New York for Indian negotiations. In the will John Walker made before he left, he appointed Mr. Jefferson, my neighbor and fast friend, as first among my executors. Walker's delegation departed for New York in early summer. Jefferson had just turned 25, and Betsy Walker was about 2 years younger. In the warm months of 1768, in visits to Belvoir, he found himself in her exclusive company, and he seems to have fallen in love with his old friend's new wife. Given the risks he was taking, the intensity of the passion Jefferson felt must have been acute. The young wife resisted, but Jefferson did not give up the chase. And though she kept Jefferson's advances secret, she allowed her anxiety to manifest itself to her husband indirectly. As John Walker recalled, his wife began to object to Jefferson serving as Walker's executor, telling me that she wondered why I could place such confidence in him. Over the next few years, Jefferson kept up his quiet campaign. On a visit of the Walkers to Shadwell, Jefferson renewed his caresses toward Betsy, slipping a note into the cuff of the sleeve of her gown. The letter, John Walker later recalled, was a paper tending to convince her of the innocence of promiscuous love. Perhaps from the hour of his humiliation in the Apollo room with Rebecca Burwell, Jefferson knew he expressed himself better in writing. To write Mrs. Walker an argued love letter, one attempting to change her mind, to convince her, was in character. The ploy failed on this occasion. Mrs. Walker said that she, on the first glance, tore Jefferson's note to pieces. Later, at a house party at the plantation of a mutual friend, John Coles, a noted hunter, Jefferson watched for a chance to steal a few moments with Betsy. One evening, when the women retired for the night, Jefferson saw his opportunity. He pretended to be sick, complained of a headache, and left the gentleman among whom I was, John Walker recalled.